musical theater people kind of live in their own funny little world. There's a lot to make fun of there, and most of us know it and share in the jokes. The idea of a musical is inherently a little silly. You mean everybody in this town knows how to sing and dance, and when a major event happens, they're all on the same page, singing the same words, seemingly in agreement about how they all feel? Musicals can be sappy, overly sincere to the point of being cringe-inducing, and rife with easily parodied cliches. But there is also a kind of poetic beauty to the concept. We all know the way a well-constructed song can communicate something true about the human emotional experience that is ineffably accurate and immediately evocative. Pair that magic with a story and you've got a musical. Characters singing their way through a situation, singing their feelings and communicating the emotion of the scenario in an inherently emotional form. When you lean into that, and let yourself be open to the absurdity of people in real situations behaving in very surreal ways, you start to understand the funny little world of musical theater people a bit more. One thing I always knew about musical theater people growing up, before I even knew why, was that they almost all hold a reverent regard for the work of Stephen Sondheim. I was 12 when I saw my first Sondheim show, a revival of Into the Woods on Broadway. I didn't get it. I thought the Princes were funny and Vanessa Williams was beautiful, but the show was mostly lost on me. I continued to do local productions of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, Guys and Dolls, and Footloose, and I continued hearing the reverence and deep respect the adults in the room always had whenever Sondheim was brought up. I didn't fully get why, but it was undeniably ubiquitous with those who did. Sondheim was different, special, rare. As time rolled on and my lifelong love affair with the theater continued, I not only grew to like Sondheim and understand Sondheim, but I also grew to revere him and respect him like everyone else. When I learned of his passing this past weekend, I cried. Not because I was holding out hope for one last musical, he gave us more than enough, or because I felt like I'd lost a personal friend, but because I was struck with the unspeakable enormity of what he has come to mean to me as an actor, a songwriter, and an artist. He is, in my humble opinion, a singular genius in a class all his own. He gave legitimacy and true depth of meaning to the form of American musical theater in a way that every composer since has aspired to emulate. He set the standard for what musical theater is capable of being, and he lived up to that standard over and over again across decades of new works. My guest today is one of those musical theater people, intimately acquainted with the weird little culture of musical theater artists. She's currently performing as part of the cast of Come From Away on Broadway. Yes, that Broadway. She's here to commiserate and to share her take on why Sondheim is such a particularly holy figure for us folk in this strange little community. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with my dear friend Emily Walton about our undying love for the greatest composer of American musical theater to ever do it, Stephen Sondheim. Okay, so you're on Broadway right now.
Yeah.
You're a Broadway actor. And someone needs to tell you. Someone needs to tell you because you've continued a series that you started when you were on tour called Saturday Night on Tour, and you refuse to adjust it from snot to snob, even though snob works well and it works really nicely because you've like stepped up to the big leagues. So now you're a snob instead of a snot, right?
Right. I never thought of myself as a snot. I just thought that snot is a funnier word. I always kind of rolled my eyes at people who do snob.
Yeah.
Because you know, it's just, it's a little like on the nose, speaking of snot.
Is that a thing that people do?
Yes. Do you not know this?
Oh, I didn't know it. I thought you invented it.
Oh my God. No, I did not invent it. I wish I had, but like, no, I started seeing Broadway actors being like, snob Saturday night on Broadway. And so when I was on tour, I thought, oh, I'm going to like, that's a good acronym, snot. I'm going to do Saturday night on tour. And so now the joke is that the really funny joke is that I'm now on Broadway, but I'm still like kind of convinced I'm on tour and everyone's always trying to correct me.
It is funny. And actually knowing the context makes it a lot funnier. Knowing,
does it?
Well, because this is a lot of what we're going to be talking about is like there is so much in-group dynamics with theater people. There is just so much stuff that like theater people are aware of that like the average person isn't aware of. And this is the thing we're talking about today is one of those things where remarkably somehow a lot of lay people are like tangentially aware of this person. And to us, it's he is the person. Yeah. He's the person. Like he's like yeah. And so it's like, okay, if you even are tangentially aware of what we do, you need to know about this guy. And still most people are like, oh yeah, you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber, Rodgers and Hammerstein, and then like you're like, and Stephen Sondheim.
Like I know, and yet at the same time, I feel like today, I went to this record store to look for specifically some Stephen Sondheim records because I got a new record player. Yes, I'm a hipster.
Yeah.
And I got A Little Night Music and Merrily We Roll Along. But the guy who was working at the record store was this man in his 70s, told me, we started chatting. He told me he was a journalist and that in the late 80s, he wrote Sondheim a letter. Like it seems like a lot of people are sharing correspondences they had with Sondheim. It seems like he was really good at responding to people's letters.
Yeah.
But so this guy who isn't, I mean, he's a New Yorker and he was a writer. So he was sort of in that scene, but he just wrote Sondheim a letter about how much he loved Sunday in the Park with George, because the way he depicted, you know, this artist is exactly the way he felt his process as a writer went. And so, you know, he's not a performer. He's never been a performer, but he had this really personal connection to Sondheim. So I do think there are random people out there who do have this relationship with him, but
definitely.
But you're right.
Yeah.
Like, but it does seem like the more pop culture icons are Andrew Lloyd Webber, and now of course like Lin-Manuel Miranda. I mean, he's contemporary, but
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so like when I do live streams and stuff, like people who follow along, they're always like surprised to find out that I'm an actor or that I do musical theater, and then when they do, they they always ask like, what's your favorite musical or what's your favorite movie or what's, you know, and I can never answer those questions. I never actually know the answer to like, what's your favorite band? What's your favorite song? I'm like, I can't even narrow it down to like top 100. There's just, and I don't have a favorite. But when people ask like, what's your favorite musical or what's your, you know, who's your favorite musical writer? I'm always sort of surprised because I'm like, well, first of all, you need to know that it's Sondheim than everyone else. So like, you don't know that somehow, like I'm like sort of surprised. I'm like, well, obviously it's a list of Sondheim musicals and then it's other shows.
Everything else.
And then it's, you know, and I think he's so unique in that way. I've been thinking a lot about this over the last few days that in so many mediums where there's like debate or contention over who the GOAT is, who the greatest of all time is, who's the best basketball player of all time, who's the best, you know, like who's the best band of all of the 20th century, you know, people have their opinions and stuff. It seems for theater folks, I don't know if you agree with this, that we don't have a lot of contention in this area. We're like, no, Stephen Sondheim's the best that ever did it. And everyone else is sort of, you know, in a different league.
Well, yeah. And also like everyone else is sort of all of the composers, all of the writers that we revere now, like I mentioned Lin-Manuel, like they all grew out of the soil that was Sondheim. But because social media is such a contentious place, I have been noticing that some people are like taking this opportunity to say things like, did he really solve the mystery of what it means to be a human? And I'm like, no, stop it. We're not doing this.
Who's doing that?
I'm not going to name names here, but I came across a post and I was like, get out of here. I don't have time for this.
If I see any Sondheim is overrated takes, I will burn the internet to the ground. I will.
Well, I don't know how you're going to. Good luck with that. I don't think that's a physical act you can do.
I'll find a way.
You'll figure it out. Uh-huh. Well, let me know what you do, because I will be right there with you. I think you're right. I feel like it's also just so crazy how many years his work spanned. Like,
it's just like I was saying this yesterday, someone, I was talking about it on a live stream, and I said, for anyone to come close, because someone said, well, Lin-Manuel's the new one. And I said, well, Lin-Manuel needs to do it for about 40 more years and write about 15 to 20 more of those shows to be in the same category. Like, it's the prolificacy that is also the thing we're talking about here, that it's like several decades of continuous genius and continuous, yes, like upping the ante and coming back and being like, you think you've seen everything that I can do, how about this? And everyone being like, oh my God, he's done it again. And like continuing to reinvent himself and to talk about new things and to find new ways to be even more brilliant. Oh, like it would take so much for someone to outdo it. You know, it's such a...
It would. And that's the thing. It's like, and I think these Lin-Manuel, or somebody mentioned Jonathan Larson too, like without Sondheim, there would have been no Jonathan Larson or Jason Robert Brown. Mm-hmm. And like, I think those writers would also probably readily admit that,
yes,
that like he is, because of how prolific he was, like there's just an undeniable impact, whether it's conscious or not. Like that's I don't know. It's hard to even put into words. Just like he's the figure of musical theater. And there's always been this feeling, at least in our lifetime, of like, okay, if I ever do a Sondheim, just that he's always around. Like, mm-hmm, if I do a Sondheim show in New York, there's a chance that maybe he'll be there. Like, there's just always this feeling of maybe one day he's going to come to this show that I'm in or something. And now it's so sad that that's just not, it just suddenly feels like, I don't know. It's just so different.
And that's the thing, though, too, is about theater people, like this, you know, like the snob and snot joke. Like, there are these things about New York theater in particular, and just the theater world, where like, even though it's a world renowned and world famous institution, and people come from all over the world to watch Broadway shows, it's still a local theater scene. And he's still like kept his career for the most part localized in that local theater scene. You know, he was just like a local theater guy who was from that town, and he never really like left the hometown to go out to do bigger and better things, which is part of the reason why he stayed a figure of like the theater world instead of being a bigger name, or not that he's not a big name, but it's just still this person where like a lot of people are like, oh, I don't think I've ever actually heard any of his shows or seen any of his shows. And you're like, wow, you know?
And I think I might be putting words into his mouth, but some interview I watched over the last few days of him where he talked about when someone said, well, this was like 10 or more years ago, someone asked what he would want his legacy to be or what he would hope for his shows once he's gone. And he just said, I just want them to be done. Community theater, regional theater, I just want the shows to keep being done. And I feel like part of why he's so revered is because he's such an artist's artist.
Yes.
It doesn't seem like his goal was ever to be the most famous, to be the figure, like the face of musical theater. He just wanted to make good work. He wanted to keep challenging himself with every show he wrote. And again, he has said things like that. I'm poorly paraphrasing what he has said, but I think that's part of it, is you can recognize that in his work, how every show he's clearly pushing himself to create something better than he could have before.
Did you share that speech from the Tonys? Someone shared it on their Instagram story. A few people did, where he's like, I want to thank the theater.
Yes, I didn't share that, but I saw that.
And he's talking about how the theater is the only form of storytelling that really acknowledges the presence of the audience. And that's what he, and I was thinking about this today, like going further with that, that the theater is this thing where, like, if you want to see a show by Sondheim, there's a few of them that are on tape. You can go watch like the PBS recording of Into the Woods or Sweeney Todd or Sunday in the Park with George. There's a few that you can find, you know, you can, I think you can find a recording of like the Raul Esparza company revival. But if you really want to experience it the way that it was experienced, you have to hope that some local theater is doing a production of one of his shows at any given time. And then you have to like go see it and just deal with whoever the actors are that are on. You just have to be like, I have to deal with like the interpretation of this director and whatever local actors they were able to get, because I'm here for the Sondheim. Like, I'm here for these songs and for these words. And that's the interesting thing about theater, is it's like we're going and watching different people giving us their best rendition of this thing that is changing and that is evolving. And but like, I always go back to like the first time people got to see it, you know, like I've been listening to Sondheim Essentials on Apple Music the last few days, and the prologue to Sweeney Todd came on, and I started thinking to myself, like, imagine being in the audience for one of the first previews of this. And at this point, he's a big star, and everyone is like expecting big things from Stephen Sondheim's new musical. He is an established Broadway mainstay for a few decades now. And you sit down, and like, this is what happens, is this haunting organ solo with this crazy like whistle that comes out, and then that insane balls to the walls opening prologue where they're like screaming, Sweeney! Like, like, I would be like, oh my God, the dude is out of control. Like, he can't be stopped. Yeah. He's, you know, like.
I don't think that was my dad's first Broadway show, but my dad saw the original Sweeney Todd, and I think if we were to ask him what his favorite Sondheim show is, he would say that, because he talks about how he remembers feeling legitimately scared. Yeah. He's like, I've never felt scared in an audience before. And yeah, he was already a Sondheim fan, but yeah, like how cool that must have been to see any of those original productions.
Yep. 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 And you're sitting there just going like, I know I'm witnessing something that is revolutionary and that has never been done before. And that like, I'm watching an artist intentionally stretch himself to his limits, and it's working. Like, it's paying off. He's taking huge risks, and he's nailing it. And he's like, he's just like, he's killing it. Like, it's, you know, it's kind of like how I imagine people felt when they saw Hamilton in previews. And it's like this massive risk, you know, say what you will about Hamilton, there's a lot of criticisms of it now that it's been a while and it's this big hit and people want to talk about all of the socio-political things around it. But I'm like, when you hear that this guy who's famous for sort of bringing hip-hop musicals to the main stage and to the mainstream is doing a hip-hop musical about Alexander Hamilton, it's like, am I really going to want to watch that? And then imagine being in the audience and being like, holy shit, he's doing it.
Like, well, and I think I didn't see it in previews, but I saw it early on in the Broadway run, and I hadn't listened to it because I wanted it to be a completely new experience for me. And I was really blown away, of course, by the writing, but also just like the production as a whole. I felt like I was watching these performers at the top of their game. The lighting design was like mind blowing. The choreography, like every element of the design of the show was so, was just so proficient, like so the best of the best. And I feel like that probably is what it felt like to see a Sondheim show too, like watching direction by James Lapine or Hal Prince and like the best designers and just people really who took their work, their artistry so seriously. But also I think it seems also had a sense of humor about themselves. Like,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Always maintaining like, That is perhaps maybe the most impressive thing about his work, is the ability to maintain some kind of self-awareness and humor and humility through all the work, that it never became this sort of self-parody of like self-seriousness. Like, even though he was always striving for more and better and new levels, he was always still like there for us. Like he was doing it for us. Like he was still, I even think about this like with Wes Anderson, like his latest movie that comes out. I'm like, he's so Wes Anderson and he's so can't not be Wes Anderson, but he's still like just a silly guy who's just trying to have like a fun time, you know? And
I think the thing about Sondheim too, as you said that, I was thinking like, how cool that somebody from his very first show, we might look at him and say, oh my God, he has already achieved a level of greatness that I couldn't even hope to achieve. But he never rested on his laurels. Like I think he believed that he could improve. Mm-hmm. And what a great way to go through life as a person and as an artist. Like there's always room for growth. There's always more to learn and more to share. And I also think he really seems to, when I hear him talk or watch clips of him, he just seems to have a really inherent admiration for humanity, or like an awe of just the human experience.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, what has kept him so relevant and so such a powerful artist.
I think that's what's so special about his shows, is that right there. You know, maybe when you get into things like Into the Woods and Sweeney Todd, you're getting into like bigger stories that have a little bit more production value and a little bit more bang to them. But he's still, the thing that makes his show so special and is that for the most part, in a lot of his shows, he's choosing subject matter that's very intimate and like, and human and small, and things that feel like they would be plays. And he's making musicals out of them, and it's just sort of like friends in an apartment having conversations, but there's, you know, company, just like singing about relationships and the way that they work and stuff like that. So revolutionary. People weren't doing stuff like that when he did that. Yeah. You know, like it felt like if something was going to be a musical, it needed a scope to its story. It needed an epic scope to justify orchestration and music, right, you know, and he would kind of take the idea of like, well, the way that people feel their feelings in relationships is epic. The way that people, like the way that people experience their lives is epic. And so he's doing that with these very human stories like Merrily We Roll Along and Company and, you know, Passion and even Sunday in the Park with George. But then he's like taking big stories like Sweeney Todd and Into the Woods and bringing those down to the human level and being like, we're going to deconstruct these and make, you know, and that's why people love him so much, specifically actors and theater people, because we're like, this is why I love this form. Is this.
Well, I know that's what I've been thinking about. I feel like I've had not a revelatory experience these last few days, but something like that where I feel like I think of him in two distinct categories, or my relationship to him is like me, the human Emily that like responds to his writing the way I do. But also then of course me, the artist, the performer, and I think it's given me a different perspective these last few days on my whole upbringing, like my parents, my whole family's life sort of revolving around theater. And
everyone's theater actors, right? You're a theater acting home.
We are a theater acting home.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's like both of my mom is not an actor anymore, but she runs a theater program for kids. She started that when I was like 12, but she was an actress all through, you know, my young years. And my dad is still an actor. My dad's in a Broadway show right now too. I don't know if I mentioned that to you, but he's a standby in Girl from the North Country,
amazing.
The Bob Dylan show, which is, I haven't seen it yet, but I hear that show is also very special.
Are you waiting till he goes on to take a night off? And
you know, I was thinking about that, but I'd like to see it once first, because I think that whenever he does go on, I'll be so nervous on his behalf that I won't be able to fully focus. Like, but yeah. And my younger brother is an actor and my uncle is an actor. So, I mean, that's like, yes, my immediate family is all, but even my mom running this theater program, like all of our conversations are about shows, musicals, right? Like if we're not talking about work, then we're talking about my mom going, I don't know what show to do with the kids this fall. And she, you know, throws out a list of the same 10 musicals. And we're like, ay, 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 mom, I don't know. Just pick one. But, but so I also, part of this thing of me going back to school is in the last almost 2 years now, I've started thinking about what it would be like for me to pursue another path, another career path. And, you know, so I've started to tentatively consider that, like a big old, like I'm talking about becoming a therapist. Like I might make a huge pivot and do something else. And I think it's, I often have trouble finding meaning, like big meaning in musical theater. Sometimes I just feel like I very easily lose sight of it. And anyway, this is a long-winded way to say Stephen Sondheim makes me feel like, and I said this in my Instagram post, it makes me feel like what we do is actually really important, is actually meaningful.
Yes.
And it makes me have a, not that I don't have admiration for my parents, of course I do, but it makes me look back on those years and go, oh my God, he was their guiding force too. He was the person that made them go, we actually are doing something worthwhile. We're not just, you know, fucking around and like singing and dancing all day long. Like we're doing something important.
Well, so much of what we, that is exactly how I feel, Emily. So much of what we do, and I talk about this all the time, that like being involved in the entertainment business is embarrassing frequently. You're constantly like doing things that are really embarrassing and putting yourselves in situations publicly that are embarrassing. And like, even like being on TikTok and stuff, it's like, there are the occasional TikToks that I'll see that I'll be like, I want to show this to people to be like, see, it's good. Like it's no, there's real, people are doing good stuff here. I know that it's a lot of like silliness and that it's a, like it's the internet. And like, I know that there's a lot of things to make fun of, but like, there are also people doing like genuinely good work here that can you can really connect with on a human level. And musical theater was that's my exact experience, that so much of it that would come out, I would see and I would be like embarrassed to be a part of this. And I'd think like, this is what the general public thinks we do. This is what they think we do. And then I would see shows like Fun Home or something. And I'd be like, no, this is what I do. This is what I'm in. This is why I love this. And then, you know, like all of the NBC live musicals and stuff. I'm like, so this is going out to millions of people. And now this is what they think musical theater is. And I am so mad because this is not what I think of. Like, this is not why I love what I do,
this is not why I started doing this. This is not why I developed such an insane passion for this art form. It wasn't to do that. But I will say, I think it is some people's passion to do that. And that's great.
Yeah.
So let them do that and we'll do the other stuff.
Right. But I have the exact same experience where Sondheim is that thing where like more than anything else, I'm like, if you could just... To people who think that musical theater is silly or that like they just can't ever shut their brain off when they're watching it because all they can think is, this is so stupid. Why does everyone know the lyrics to the song all of a sudden? Like, what is this? I'm like, spend some time with some Sondheim musicals, like spend some and see if you can lose yourself in that. See if you can like connect to the poetry and to the way that man phrases something, a thought where you're like, oh my God, that's the exact way I have that thought. That's the exact way I think about that.
But then I wonder about, I've been thinking about this because I started watching that Beatles documentary too. I don't know if you've watched Get Back, that is on Disney Plus.
I haven't watched it yet, no.
But just thinking about the different approach to songwriting, like people who create songs to, like with the intention of making somebody feel something, to see themselves in the song, to feel deeply, because I feel like so much of the pop music I know now, I wouldn't guess that, like, no offense to her, she's very talented, but like, is Ariana Grande trying to make us feel deeply by singing about like 69ing all day long? Like, I don't think that's her intention. Forgive me, Ariana, if you're listening. Like, what a great song.
Does she want us to emotionally connect to the wrist icicle from giving a hand job and getting cum on your wrist?
Wait, is that something about?
Yeah, that's something in that song, the one about like side to side, how it was the
oh my God,
dick bicycle, get wrist icicle. Like it was like,
I don't even want to know. Also, the fact that in that 69 song, I know it's called 34 plus 35 or whatever, but the fact that the whole song, she's like 34, 35, and she's singing all about, okay, this coy thing, we know you're talking about 69ing. And then at the end of the song, she goes, as it's fading out, she goes, that means I want a 69 with you. Do you know that?
No.
In the last like 5 seconds of the song, I'm like, honey, we know that's what you're singing about. You don't have to tell us.
When Sondheim said at the end of Anyone Can Whistle, that means I want a 69 with you. I knew this man gets it.
That I knew he was trying to connect with us emotionally. Anyway, this is all to say, I'm thinking about some of those musicals. Like, if we're talking about, let's talk about Grease, because like those writers aren't alive anymore. So,
yeah.
Well, but like, come on, is those magic changes? I don't even know the name of the song. Like, they didn't write that to try to like make us think and feel deeply. But I feel like Sondheim really wanted us to think and feel deeply.
He was always trying to find a succinct way to phrase something where where we in the audience could hear it and go, and nod our head and go, yes. And go, I know, and you just hear it over and over again in his work that he's trying to find this like succinct idiom to be like, this thing that this moment in this show is about is right here. You're always sorry, you're always grateful. Like right there, boom. Like and that's it. And you hear it and you're like, oh god damn. Yes, dude. Yes.
And you can spend years of your life thinking about what that means for you or applying it to different scenarios that you're living through. Like it's so it's just so human. It's so human.
So you were raised in a musical theater family and everyone, I'm sure, was like you said in your post on Instagram that was so beautiful that like, you know, your dad's like singing and your mom and dad are like singing Sondheim songs as lullabies and stuff. Is there an age when you feel like you were aware of like what Sondheim was doing or did it always connect with you? Or did you feel like you got it to an age where you're like, oh, this is why my parents are so extra nerdy about this guy? Like,
I think it was the latter. I mean, I think like, I grew as a young kid, you know, my parents singing Nothing's Gonna Harm You as a lullaby and me singing Broadway Baby with my mom when I was six. Like those are real memories I remember, but those songs were just a natural part of my existence. It wasn't like, and now we're going to sing you a song by the greatest composer of all time.
Yeah.
Stephen, like these were just beautiful songs that were a part of my life.
Right.
And then I think when I got to be about 13, I started for a time, I was like auditioning professionally to do things. And I didn't really stick with, you know, I took a break to go to school and then started again. But in 1 week, I auditioned for the revival of Into the Woods that was in like 2000 or somewhere around there.
I saw that show.
Vanessa
Williams. I didn't even see. Yeah,
Vanessa Williams, that one. I auditioned to play Little Red, mm-hmm. and then I auditioned for a regional production of A Little Night Music to play Frederica. Mm-hmm. But the audition for that song, I had to learn the full cut version of The Glamorous Life. That's like a 14-page song for that little girl. And I remember at age 12 or 13, like working my ass off to learn these songs, like note for note, lyric for lyric, and I think that's when it really started to speak to me just in terms of like the mastery of it as a performer where you're like, oh my God, I got to get this right. I want to get this right. So I feel like I had an awareness even then that it was like forcing me to really focus and work hard and not just like sing a pretty song and like smile and sway. Like I had to really tap into something. I didn't get either of those jobs, just for the record. I did that fucking 14-page song. I did it in an audition and I had it memorized because I was 13 and that's what I could do. But sure. Like, so I think that's when the change started happening. The change that everyone always talks about. And then in high school, like I started doing, you know, I did a couple Sondheim shows and I was like, oh my God, he's speaking to me. And so I think it was, I think it was like adolescence is when I really started to get
that 2000 revival. Was the first time I ever went to New York. I was like 12 years old and we went and saw that show and my young brain, you know, how like as a kid, you'll just sort of like edit things out of movies that you don't understand or stuff that you'll just be like that part just goes away. Cause you're like, I don't know what they're talking about. So like, I literally like don't remember the second act. Like I just was like the first act ended, and in my brain as a kid, I was like, that's the end of all of the fairy tales, the end. I was like, and then the second act happened, and I was like, this is boring. Why is it still going? The show ended.
It's boring, it's dark. Yeah,
like, what's happening? And I remember you know, then he, like everyone talking about the show when I got to college and about what a genius show it was. And I was like, I saw that on Broadway when I was 12 and I kind of thought it was okay. And I was like, I don't know. And then I remember being in my room one night watching it on an iPad, like watching the PBS recorded version and just like beside myself sobbing, like just like, inconsolably sobbing at this moment that now I can't watch it or even think about it without getting emotional, of like these frustrated children who are looking at these adults and being like, help me with this situation. And the adults are like, I don't actually have an answer for you. And I'm so sorry. I'm also confused. And I wish I could tell you that like, here's what to do, but I don't really know. And if it helps at all, we're all like this and you're not alone. And I just was like, what a fucking incredible thing to put in a show. Like this moment where it's just like, what an honest, insane thing to put in a show about fairy tales. This moment where these adults who are like equally lost, like the baker's marriage has fallen apart and so is Cinderella's. And they're just like, I don't fucking know. And they're trying to console these children who one of them, his mom just died. And like, you know, and then as the song ends, there's this thundering approach of the next issue. They don't even get a moment to like breathe and think about it. It's just like up next, the next thing. And I don't know. I think then is when I was like, okay, this is what everyone's talking about. And then I just started to approach all of his shows with that lens of like, this guy's a genius. And then once I knew that, watching the shows, it was like easy. It was just like, oh my God, he's so good. He's so smart.
Well, and it's like, no matter how many times you listen to or watch these shows, there's still so much more to learn about them. I feel like every time I revisit one of the shows, I hear a lyric in a new way. I remember when I had been listening to Sunday in the Park with George, I was like 18 or 19, 18 maybe. And the day that I realized when she was saying, I mean like do George, he needs me. I mean like do George. Mm-hmm. I always thought it was needs, N-E-E-D-S. And then I heard it and I was like, oh my God, she's saying needs, K-N-E-A-D-S. And I like lost my mind. I was so excited.
Yep.
Because that, I mean, and maybe that's a really obvious one, but at the time it didn't feel obvious to me. And like,
it's not obvious. Just, it's not.
When you're a teenager, you're like, I'm just listening to this song. And right. But when that sort of clicked, I was like, this fucking guy.
Yeah, you're like, he needs dough, smart. Money. Like D-O, like he needs.
Yeah, he needs me like dough. He needs me like dough, George.
Yeah, he needs some dough.
It was about a mafia boss. Is it not? Not.
Yeah. I had the same moment with when I was living in New York. I got the cast album of Company in high school for Christmas one year, and I listened to it, you know, over and over and over again, and I loved the show, and I really connected with it, but also I was like a teenager and had never been in that situation. And then I was living in New York and all my friends were married and stuff, and I was, you know, like in my late 20s, and I was at the gym one day listening to that, and all of a sudden it like hit me that I was like, oh my God, I've become this guy. Yeah. And I like had to leave the gym because I was crying, because I just was like, I'm this guy now. I'm Bobby. And that his shows will do that. They will like grow with you. Like they will. I imagine there will be a day in my life where I'm going to listen to Follies and I'm going to be like, oh my God.
It's me. I'm sorry. I have to go back to you saying that you were listening to Company at the gym. That was like your pump up music. You're like, oh, so times. I mean, listen, I've done that before. But I know when I found out in this revival of Company that is happening that I haven't seen yet, that she, Bobby, because, you know, she's now being, it's that gender bent production, right? Like, 35. Right. That's just about, I'm just about there.
Yeah.
Come on. Please just make her 40. Give me a few more years. I can't be thinking about that.
Yeah.
I'm not ready to connect with that character yet, but I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh, it's all so sophisticated. He's so sophisticated.
Well, and it's the layers, you know, and great artists are that way, that every time you come back to their work, you find new things, you find new layers that you'd never seen before. And that's why the work is so enduring, is because you can keep coming back and keep going, oh my God, how did I never hear that before? Or how did I never see that before? And it's just this gift that keeps on giving.
And that's the word enduring is like, I don't know. That's so much, that's so present in Sunday in the Park with George specifically because it's about art.
Yes.
But like, I think, did you watch any footage of the singing Sunday yesterday?
Yes, I did.
I was there. I was there singing.
I was going to ask if you were there.
I was there. And it was so beautiful. And Lin-Manuel read some passages from Look, I Made a Hat. And
y'all made me cry with your singing. Yeah.
Oh, it was so, it was insane. It was so beautiful, emotional, mm-hmm. And sad. But when Lin was quoting the book, when Sondheim talks about that, like once during the writing of every show, he cries,
yes.
like at some point, and that he talks about that moment where they sing Forever. I'm going to start crying now, but when they sing Forever in that song, that like thinking about these people in the painting, that like what it would be like to know they were being immortalized in a great work of art. Like that's what this is. And that's what we were doing yesterday. That's what people will be doing for generations to come with his music. Like, it's just so, it's profound. It's really like that he felt so deeply and thought so deeply about, and that's what Children in Art, I always think about Children in Art too. That's one of the songs I always go to because I remember having conversations with my parents about this when I was younger. Like, those are the two enduring things. Those are the legacies in life, right? Like, you can have children and that's how you go on, and you can make art and that's how you go on. Like, and just to, that's it. Like, you just wrote a song called Children in Art. You just like captured the entire human experience in a three word title of a song. Like, what?
Yeah. That's the other thing is like I said this earlier, how he's trying to find these like really succinct ways to say things like Children in Art, but it's simultaneously incredibly verbose and thick and like, and dense and also remarkably simple. That it will also just be these, you can like boil it down to this like one thing and just be like, there it is right there, you know? And there's so many of those. I was going to ask you that. I was going to say, you're in the city. I saw that clip and I was just like instantly crying. It came up on TikTok and I was like, oh my God. I was like, because I love theater people and it also just shows again how much this person means to us. We don't do that for everyone, that every one of our fallen heroes. I was going to ask you if you had been to any events, because when I was living in New York, David Bowie died. And I remember thinking like, I need to go sing karaoke tonight and I need to go sing some David Bowie songs. And I went to a bar and it was like the best, one of the coolest experiences of my life. Everyone there was there for the same reason. We all had the same idea. And we all were just one after another singing our favorite Bowie songs and singing our guts out and like hugging and dancing and like, and I heard people did that last night. I wonder if, did you go to anything else or was it just the Sunday in Times Square?
I didn't. I just did that because like we still have our, you know, it's like we're still doing our regular show schedule. Right. So that was kind of the only thing I could make it to. But that was like, there was also something so special about that. Well, in addition to just what it was, but that it was people who are currently in Broadway shows and knowing that most of these people probably started wanting to be on Broadway because of him. Like, he's like the father of all of us that were there, you know, like,
yeah.
Oh, that's the only event I went to, but it was a good one. And I'm standing next to my uncle who was in the original cast of Merrily We Roll Along. And he, you know, he knew Sondheim. I mean, he had a friendship with him. He had a relationship with him. So I think that is a whole other thing where I was like, he's mourning like the loss of a person, not just like a figure, you know?
Did you guys, I imagine theaters are doing some kind of thing before shows or after shows with the audience, or are they doing things as a cast? Like, did they bring you out on stage and go, hey, let's have a moment, or no? Did you just
No. So it was weird on Friday between, we had two shows on Friday because it was the day after Thanksgiving. And I was just in the dressing room with my dressing roommate in between shows. And my friend who's a dresser on the show texted me and said, and it just said Sondheim died. And I was like, Oh my God. And I told my dressing roommate, and then people started coming up onto the floor and we were talking. And so we were just all kind of congregating in my dressing room talking about it. And we like did a little toast to him just on our own, but no, there was no, I think because we're not doing a Sondheim show, it yeah. maybe felt like, but I know that night, especially we were all like thinking about him and like, let's do this for him. Like, let's thank him through this. But I mean, I don't know when they're going to dim the lights, but I think that will be probably a big moment, and everyone will, I'm sure a lot of people will turn out for that. And there's probably going to be some big ass memorial. I mean, what, you know, like there's going to be something major being planned.
I know a guy in that company revival, and he said that the stage manager called them all to the stage and was like, hey guys, Steve died today, you know? And I'm like, oh, what a wild thing, you know?
Well, also go ahead. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to say the timing right now is so interesting. Sometimes the universe has such great timing, like this Tick, Tick, Boom movie, which is beautiful. I don't know if you've seen it. It's really well done, I thought. And like Bradley Whitford's like very touching portrayal.
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, it's lovely. And it's like such nice timing. And then you've got West Side Story coming out, the movie, and then you've got this revival on Broadway. I'm like, what a nice little like moment.
It is.
What were you gonna say, Zari?
Oh no, I was just going to say that I watched the clip of the company cast on stage talking to the audience, the director talking to the audience. Did you see this?
No.
Well, so I thought it was a post show. Thank you for coming. You know, let's take a moment to talk about Sondheim. But I realized it was before the evening performance. So they like raised the curtain and the cast was all just standing there with their arms around each other. So the audience got to sort of meet the cast as just themselves before watching them on stage, which I thought was really cool. I haven't seen that before. And it was just kind of a nice neutralizing thing of going like, hey, we're actually mourning this right now. And let's, you know, this performance, and Patti LuPone says like, tonight's performance and every performance of this show for the entire run is dedicated to Steve. And, you know.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. What a great time to be in that city. Definitely this week, the last few days have been like, I wish I was in that city just to go to some piano bars and like, and sing a tune or two and be in that energy. How do you feel? I mean, we've talked so much about like what he means to us, and I think we've hopefully driven that home for listeners that like, if you don't know, this is a very important person to us. I was with my parents and I heard, and then I like turned around and looked at them and I was crying, and they were like, are you okay? And I was like, I just can't even say how much this person means to me. And I don't cry when celebrities die, but I was like, I'm just
neither
like, yeah. And it's not like I'm sad that he's like gone. He was very old. It's neither just that the gravity of like what he means.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you feel or do you feel that he's influenced you as like a songwriter or an artist, like your personal art? Do you feel consciously that you're influenced, or do you think subtly or both?
I honestly, I think it's a little of both, probably more subtly than overtly, because like I think the thing that he has inspired most in me as a writer myself is just a love of words. Like he is clearly so obsessed with language. And I feel like I've learned so much from him about rhymes and reading Look, I Made a Hat and Finishing the Hat were so great because it's him just, you know, dissecting his lyric writing process. And it's like, so I think in those ways, like I have so much fun when I'm writing lyrics. I have a lot of fun with trying to find internal rhymes and trying to find clever rhymes that maybe few people have thought of, but you know, like, so that's definitely something that he's influenced me a lot on. But no, I mean, other than that, I think that's the main thing. But as a performer, you're just like, whenever I've gotten to sing any of his music, it's just, you feel like, I like when I've auditioned for his, for shows, productions of his, regional productions, I like almost can't do it because I feel as I'm doing it, like so honored and emotional, like honored to get to even do it in that setting, like in an audition room. I auditioned for a production of Sunday in the Park with George. I was definitely too young to play Dot. I don't know what anybody was thinking, but like I got to go in and sing the song Sunday in the Park with George, like her first song. And then I got called back somehow miraculously and I got to sing Children in Art. And I was just like, I can't fucking do this because it just feels like I want so badly to live up to this song. I want, even just in this audition room with a piano and three people that I don't know, like, you know, I just, mm-hmm. I want to be able to like handle this with such care. And yeah, so that's like, I guess you try to imbue everything you do as a performer with that level of precision and focus, even if it doesn't technically require it. I think that's the thing about his writing too, is it's just, you're like, I gotta focus here. I gotta really, like, I really have to narrow in on what I'm trying to accomplish here. Like, whereas with other shows and songs, you kind of can just do them and you can be on autopilot a little bit. I don't think you can be on autopilot with his stuff, but.
No, I mean, and you talked about that a little bit earlier too, like that auditioning for those shows when you were so young and trying to learn that music and being like, oh, this is so difficult. Because if you listen to a cast recording, and I think people hear musical theater actors talking about how difficult Sondheim is a lot, it doesn't sound as difficult as it is. It sounds, and it shouldn't. It should sound, from the actor who's performing it, it should, you know, be easy to follow by the audience and stuff. But there are all these, I mean, like, I remember doing a lot of these songs in voice lessons. And initially, as my, like, voice teacher is, like, plunking out the melody and I'm learning the melody of the song and following along, it's like, I don't know what the big deal is here. But then when they start doing the arrangement and they're like, trying to get me to do the exact syncopations of the rhythm. And I'm like, why is it like that? Why is it not more even? Why that's so hard to count. And they're like, you don't have to get it if you don't want to. I'm like, no, I want to get it.
No,
like,
I want to. But that's the thing. I feel like that was such a great turning point for me, where at age 13, I could have gone, ah, fuck this. I'm too lazy. I don't want to do this. But instead, for whatever reasons, I decided, no, I really want to do this. Right. Mm-hmm. I feel like that helped set the stage, no pun intended, for like, for the, you know, I'd like to believe that I take what we do seriously and I do put work in and I want to sing the notes that are on the page. I don't want it to just be like a broad stroke, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
yeah.
Did you have a chance to look at the outline that I sent over?
Yeah, I did.
Any chance that you were able to like round up five songs? We talked about it earlier that I'm like, it's so hard. It's like impossible.
I was like, I can do this. Five songs. Yeah. And now I'm looking at my list and it's like 12, but I mean, I can give you five. I can make it five.
I did the same thing. I wrote five. And then I was like every time someone asks me, what's your favorite movie? Anything like that? I'm like, I'll say the first thing that comes to mind. Cause maybe there's something to that. That like whatever comes up first. But then as I'm going through, I'm like, oh,
but it's, you're right. That's such a, I feel the same way, not just about musicals, but about all forms of entertainment. I'm like, I can't, everything serves a different purpose. Like I listen to Company when I'm in a certain mood. I listen to Sunday in the Park with, like, they're not, it's not like a favorite. It's just a feeling, a mood, like a phase or something.
I'm the same way. Like, I definitely don't want to be like, this is my definitive list. In my opinion, the best song. And no, I don't feel this way, but these are, as I was like trying to list them out, I'm like, well, I guess these are the first five. And then I wrote seven.
Can we exchange?
Yeah, let's exchange.
Will you tell me yours?
I'll tell you mine and we'll see. I imagine we've got a few in common, but we'll see.
Should we do like one for one? Or
yeah,
do
you do one and I'll do one. So you do
your... I'll start?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Our Time.
That's on my list.
Yes.
That's on my list.
That's great. It's okay. I mean, come on.
It's, you know, in those early works, you don't typically hear, it's a surprisingly like contemporary melody for,
yes,
you know
is.
What I mean? Like it,
yeah.
It's very like, almost like poppy. Like it's such a nice melody. And you don't, he was writing more like show tunes a lot earlier, like that sounded more old school show tunes. That song is like, a ballad that still works for anyone's audition book today. And it's also one of those songs where the arrangement is surprisingly difficult. It sounds very, very easy. Ba-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da. But there's all these little syncopations that make it surprisingly hard. But then it's just got like really simple, pure harmonies that are gorgeous. And it's also just like so earnest. And
oh my God, it's so earnest. And I sang it at my eighth grade graduation. I've sung it like you sing it at these like young early life milestones. And it's like that lyric that I always like when we were teenagers and leaving my mom's theater program, we would always think about that lyric. Years from now, we'll remember and we'll come back by the rooftop and hang a plaque. This is where we began being what we can. Kill me. Oh my God. And we did a review at my mom's theater. Are you okay?
There was a hanging shirt over here, a laundry, and I thought it was a person. And I was like, ghost. I thought I saw a ghost.
Your eyes kind of glazed over. Like I saw fear in your eyes.
I literally was like, oh my God, there's a person standing there. How long have they been standing there and why?
That was so funny to witness. Yeah. Whatever. Anyway, whatever. We don't need to talk about that. Okay. So whatever.
Whatever.
Now you go.
No, so yeah, our time. And also like I heard in an interview once, he was talking about how he goes, everyone thinks that I write very autobiographically. And he's like, he goes, they think that Bobby's me or that George is me and all this stuff. He's like, I don't. And he goes, the only time I've really written autobiographically, and it was a specific song in Merrily We Roll Along. I can't remember which song. It wasn't Our Time. But I was like, he goes, Merrily We Roll Along is maybe my most autobiographical work just because it's about, you know, me and all of my cohorts at that time in the 50s going to producers' offices and knocking on the doors and trying to make our voices heard. And I heard that and I was like, yeah, maybe that's the only time you wrote intentionally autobiographically, Steve, but I think that you're in all of it. I think that
of course you're in all of it.
Like you're writing for other characters in made up situations, but you can't help but be in it, you know, but that's also what's special about Merrily We Roll Along and Our Time is it really does feel like some of the only work where he's like intentionally being like, this is about me. This is about how I felt as a young artist. And so that's a really special one. Okay, I'll go.
Okay, you go.
This is a weird one. This is one that I feel like is not going to be on your list. Joanna.
It's not on my list, but I mean, that's not weird. Why is that a weird one?
I think it's weird because it's not like one of those like...
Don't look at that shirt again. Did you just look at that shirt again?
I have to make sure it's not an actual ghost. There's
just
a person.
Make sure it doesn't turn into a person.
Yeah. Now it has legs. No.
Oh, no. Pants.
The reason I like that's on my list is because, first of all, I think that score is the biggest departure in his body of work. Like I said, like you, that prologue, you go into that show as a Sondheim fan sitting down for the first time when it's premiering and you're like, oh, this is different territory. He's really pushing himself into different territory. And you hear melodies early on. There's no place like London. And you hear these bom, 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 these like grand things, but mostly it's da, 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 ba, ba. And it's very like dark and moody. Yeah. And I feel like Joanna is this song that really like shocks the listener because it all of a sudden emerges out of this mucky score, this score that's like this like muddy, mucky, like gritty score that you never know at what time a whistle's just gonna scream at you or screech at you. And there's all these dissonant harmonies and these people literally screlting, like screaming at you on the stage. And all of a sudden there's like the most gorgeous ballad he's ever written in the middle of the that just like emerges and you're like, and it's such a relief. It's such a like, oh, thank you for at least giving me this moment. And obviously later on in the show, he's got the other one too, but like, so that's on
my list. No, that's also like, I'm just thinking the list I have, I don't think I'm going to be able to articulate exactly why, like you just did. That was really, you said that so eloquently, but I don't think I'm going to be able to do that all these.
That's my best guess. I just like the melody. I just like it.
Well, that's the thing. I feel like most of these that I wrote down are just like, I like the way it makes me feel. Is that fair?
Yes. That's hard. Yes.
I'm going to do another one. Okay. This is a bit of a surprise to all of the listeners, I'm sure. A Weekend in the Country.
Mm-hmm.
I just love that song.
Okay. All right. That's not on my list.
That's okay. It's not one that I will like just put on to listen to and feel good. I really like playing all the different parts in it when I'm singing. Like I like deciding, okay, today I'm going to be Petra. And then just like doing her. It's so lyrically dense and such an exciting act one finale. And like, I just think it's just so freaking great.
Let's help our listeners too. If just in case there's people who are like, chose. I want to listen to these songs. So Weekend in the Country is from A Little Night Music.
A Little Night Music. Yes.
And Joanna is from Sweeney Todd and Our Time is from Merrily We Roll Along. So
that's right.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a fun one. I like that. That's like an outside pick for me.
Yeah, because all of these other ones I'm looking at are like the sad ones. So yeah. That's okay.
I'm betting this is on your list.
What?
No One Is Alone.
It's not on my list.
It's not on your list. No.
I mean, it's on the list of 100,000 songs, but it's not on this list. No. But you talked about why you love that one.
I talked about it earlier that I think it's just like one of the most like profound moments in all of musical theater that comes as a surprise. That whole second act, you're like, oh, this is different. This is different. And then that song is like, oh my God, what a gorgeous little moment of honesty and, I'm back.
Okay.
Sorry, I got a call, but yeah. Okay. So that one.
Okay. Let's see another one that I wrote.
And that's from Into the Woods. For anyone.
That's right.
Into the Woods. Yeah.
Okay. This is another one. This is Sunday in the Park with George. Finishing the Hat. I mean.
Yeah.
That on your list?
It's not on my list. It should be.
Okay.
Honorable mention. Honorable mention.
It really should be. Finishing the Hat is just like, oh, if you ever want to think or learn or, yeah, just think about what it feels like to be an artist and like how isolating it can feel. That's it.
It's the thing that like people don't realize when they're going to a museum and they're looking at a body of work by a painter or like they don't realize the levels of like of analysis that can go into the tiniest things. You look at it and you go, oh, that's a nice painting. Oh, cool. Oh, so George Seurat made this with a bunch of little dots. That's cool. Oh, and it was called pointillism. That's a cool little thing. But you're not thinking that like the process of making this, he was agonizing over how to capture the light on the side of a hat and how much yellow or orange to add to it to add that dimension to it, or should it all just be black, or should like, you know, and like literally mix these little teeny tiny things that are spending so much time that it's like impeding your ability to have relationships and to like be out living life because you're deciding that what you want to leave in the world is this painting, is this work. And so you're, you know, yeah, it's, and like you said, the way that it's isolating and yeah.
Do you like Bo Burnham?
Huh?
Okay. Because I think about, I watched his, I love his Netflix special.
It's incredible. And
it's so fucking incredible.
Yeah.
I've watched it many times and I've thought like, what a process that must, because he's such a one man band, literally. Uh-huh. I'm like, he must spend so much time alone. He must spend so much time in a room figuring out, I mean, especially with that piece, but like with all of his songwriting, all of his work, you're like, oh, now I'm getting a call. No, Mom.
We're very popular.
No, Mom.
No, Mom.
Mom, I can't. But like, I've just wondered about that with him specifically. And also, fun fact, Bo Burnham shared a picture of Sondheim on the day he died and just put a little goat emoji. And I was like, I like this. Of course, Bo Burnham was influenced by Sondheim. Like, of course,
yeah.
You know?
Yep.
Anyway. Okay. So now you go.
Okay. From Company, Being Alive. Do you have it?
Not on my list.
But I can't believe
how different.
I'm actually really happy. I'm really happy that our lists are different.
But also, as you say your songs that are not on my list, I'm not over here going like, ugh, snooze fest. That's not like.
Or like basic. Basic.
Yeah, basic. Basic. And boring.
I feel like my picks are kind of basic. But
no, you didn't say that. That's the thing. There's no such thing as basic with Stephen Sondheim. There is no basic. But I know what you're saying. Pop, more popular, more.
This was a lyric that I, as a teenager, someone did it at a voice recital. And I think that's the first time I ever heard this song. And like the humanity and the simplicity, and this has influenced me as a songwriter a lot, the simplicity of like talking about like someone sitting in my chair. Like I have a chair at my house that's my favorite chair and someone who's sitting in my favorite chair. Like, and it's annoying, but I want it. I want someone to sit in my chair and bug me and ruin my sleep and like, and you know, and hog the covers and stuff. Like the simplicity of that lyric hit me so hard as a teenager that he didn't need to like be too complex with it. It was just so simple. And I instantly got it. I was like, oh, okay. This person is saying that he wants all of the complexity that comes with lifelong companionship. You know,
he's ready.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you ready for my next one?
Mm-hmm.
I think the next one is, I'm trying to choose off of this long list. Like It Was, also from Merrily We Roll Along.
Ooh.
Now that's a song that is a depressing one. I played Mary when I was 16, and that whole show just really like still speaks to me and makes me feel so nostalgic and emotional. But like that she's just singing about why can't it be like it was? Their friendship has fallen apart. And like the beginning of the song, she's like, you and me, we were nicer then. We were nice. Kids and cities and trees were nice. And like, and then she says, I don't know who we are anymore. And I'm starting not to care. Mm-hmm. Like that hurts to think about. But like, I just think it also captures, I think, a specific moment in like adulthood, in young adulthood, you know, where you're going, why are these friendships disintegrating? Why do I not feel as wide-eyed as I used to?
I think we're making a better playlist than Apple Music did when I listened to their...
Really?
So if people are following along and you want to make this playlist, you should do it. Or I guess... I'm not on Spotify. I know that that's like the place to make playlists.
You're not?
No, I need to get on Spotify.
You need to get on Spotify.
I know. I like my music's on Spotify. I'm just not on... I use Apple Music and I don't know
why.
Yeah.
It works for you. I'm going into a different room.
Yeah. What's happening? Okay. Do you have a ghost now?
I have a ghost. Yes. I have a ghost, a shirt and pants and shoes. No, I just want to plug my computer in because it's the battery's low.
Okay. Are you good on time? Are you okay?
I am. I think I need to go in like probably 10 minutes or so. Yeah. Is that okay?
Yep. Totally.
I'm going to see Freestyle Up Supreme tonight.
Ooh, that's dope.
Ooh! Okay.
Okay, we'll do a couple more each. I've got Sunday from Sunday in the Park with George. And this is one of them.
I do too.
Okay. So this is one that, I like the lyrics in the song and everything, but this is one, like you said, where you're like, I just like the way it makes me feel. There is, melodically, this song just makes me feel so nice. It's just such a, it's such a like epic melody.
It's so epic.
It's such a, I love when he gets really epic because he's kind of like known generally for being like a patter guy with like dissonant melodies and stuff like that. And I really love when he just gets big and epic like that, where it feels like the score to a great movie or something. And it just feels very cinematic and big in scope. And
And also the biggest, the peak of that song is when everyone is singing the word forever, which, and especially now knowing his feeling about writing that part, it's just like, it's powerful. And you're like, I'm crying. And I'm not sure if I'm crying because of the way the music is making me feel or the lyrics or both. And that's maybe the Sondheim experience in a nutshell, is like, is it the music or the lyrics or is it just all of it that's just making me weep?
I was going to say that earlier when you were talking about Jonathan Larson and Jason Robert Brown, I was like, definitely the way that those guys were influenced. And I think that the way that a lot of people were influenced is, I was saying this to my parents because they were like, what do you think he did first? Do you think he did like lyrics or melody or music first? And I'm like, well, I don't really know. I haven't actually heard what his process was like. I'm sure that there was a mixture of both at different times and things like that. But I think that something that set him apart and that contemporary composers have emulated is this idea that like the orchestration and the music is part of it, that that's also a character. And so part of the song, it's not just finding music to live underneath the melody, where you hear a lot of that with other older composers where it's like, we just need to find something that lives nicely under this melody and lyric. The way that he constructed the piano was part of it. The way that he constructed like the different instruments coming, it was all very particular and part of it. And I think you hear that the roots, you know, in Jason Robert Brown and in these people who are like, oh, I want my orchestration to also be very prominent and be.
Yeah. It's a part of the whole like aural experience of it.
Yeah. Okay. You go.
I go. Mm-hmm. I mean, Children in Art from Sunday in the Park with George. Yeah. Is that on your list?
It's not on my list, but that's a good one.
I mean, I've talked about it enough, Jesus. But it's just like, there are just so many quotable lyrics in that song that you're just, that make you think about, well, Children in Art, Austin.
Yep.
So that's one. But can I also just, while I'm on the topic of Sunday in the Park with George, also another one on my list is We Do Not Belong Together. Just like really makes you feel, really makes you feel. Now this conversation is just getting, you know, the thing about Sondheim is he makes you feel.
You guys go listen to Sondheim. You gotta.
He makes you feel.
You gotta. One that I really like that I feel like, it's kind of one of those where it's like still got it, like a still got it song is, and there's a few from this musical that I really, really like, but this one I'm like, I think is special and underrated is Something Just Broke from Assassins.
You know what? I'm glad you said that because I was just thinking we haven't said anything from Assassins and I love that song.
Yeah. And like on the topic, like I also love, Unworthy of Your Love, just because it's like such a batshit insane song.
And it's so poppy,
It's so poppy and it's so like lovely. And then the subject matter is juxtaposed with the subject matter. It's just like, you really did that, didn't you? You really wrote a duet with John Hinckley and Squeaky Fromm about how John Hinckley's obsessed with like a child, Jodie Foster. And Squeaky Fromm's obsessed with Charles Manson, and it's this really lovely love song.
Yep.
Yeah.
We did a review actually. So my mom every year for her theater program, we do a gala, like a benefit for the theater company. And we get like our Broadway friends to come and sing a bunch of songs and it's always great. And this year we actually did a Sondheim. It was a completely Sondheim review. Mm-hmm. And I sang Unworthy of Your Love with my friend Adam, and my friend who had never heard that song before texted me during the show. And she was like, that song's.
Oh no.
Charles Manson. What happened?
You just cut out for a little bit. The audio cut out. You're back though.
You want to know why that happened?
Why?
I was flicking open my little AirPod case. Oh. That's why.
Your friend said that song's fucked up.
He said that song is really fucked up and I'm upset that you were singing about Charles Manson. Like it really like, upset her.
Oh, geez. I'm surprised that people would be more upset by that than about the Jodie Foster thing. I think that to me is more.
I think people don't know that she was a child. I think people aren't thinking about that.
That she was like 13 when she did that. Yeah.
Oh, no, it's definitely fucked up.
But Something Just Broke is like one of those titles, like you said, Children in Art, where it's like, it's right there. Something Just Broke. This moment of like when people try to describe what 9/11 felt like or what these kind of flashbulb moments and getting it, you know, that's a still got it thing where he's like, I nailed it. Something just broke. Everyone, when they heard this, something just broke. It just was.
I remember exactly where I was. Uh-huh. It's a very chilling song too. Yep. Can I tell you a funny story about that song?
Yeah.
So this involves Drew, my ex-boyfriend, but it always made me laugh. We were talking about that song and I was like, wouldn't it be funny if there were characters in that song? Like if Santa Claus was a character in that song singing about where he was when he learned about JFK. And then we were talking about like, what if the Tooth Fairy was one of the characters? And Drew was like, did an impression of the song. He was like, this isn't going to go over well, this joke, but I'm going to tell you. He was like, I was stealing Tifu's. First of all, okay, so it was just he said, I was stealing Tifu's. And when we were 19 years old, he said that, I laughed so hard I peed my pants because Tifu's is nothing. But he was just trying to fill the space. Imagining that the Tooth Fairy was like, I remember where I was. I was stealing teeth. Like,
I was riding in my sleigh. Yeah, yeah. I was over North Dakota.
Right, right. It's funny. Isn't that funny?
I was out stealing teeth.
Like, he was just trying to say it so fast, and God, it tickled me. I still laugh.
That's really geez. Funny.
Yeah, I really love that.
Okay, one more each. One more each.
Okay. Fuck. This is a weird one to end with, yeah. But I feel like we should mention Follies. We haven't said anything about Follies either. Waiting for the Girls Upstairs from Follies.
Yes.
Another sort of up-tempo, definitely worthless. Like, I sang that in Sondheim, of the production of Sondheim on Sondheim that I did, and I didn't really know that song well. And it's so challenging musically, and it's so, you know, you're seeing the older couples singing about their younger selves, and it's just this, like, it's just really great.
Yes. That's again, like, where I feel like I'm gonna listen to Follies, or I'm gonna see a revival of it in 20 years, and I'm gonna be like, oh my god, yep. It's me now.
It's me. I know.
Okay, my last one, another show we haven't really talked about, Pacific Overtures. Can you guess which song from Pacific Overtures I would say?
Can't, because I don't know Pacific Overtures.
Or am I? Wait, hold on. I actually
cut this part out, Austin.
What's that?
Cut this part out. I don't know Pacific Overtures, and I'm ashamed.
You know what?
But I will. What?
You know what, Emily? I don't know Pacific Overtures because I thought this song was from Pacific Overtures, and it's not.
What's it from?
It's from A Little Night Music.
What if this whole episode is just us completely butchering the canon of Sondheim?
Like, we're never no right. There's just
we're
people
talking about, like, Guys and Dolls. We're like, my favorite Sondheim is Adelaide's Lament.
Adelaide's Lament. I love when Simba is singing after.
Oh, when he sings, Can You Feel the Love Tonight? I can't. Wait, what song?
Send in the Clowns.
From the
Why did I think it was from Pacific Overtures?
I don't know.
That's what I had written down, and I, yeah.
No, Send in the Clowns is classic.
Yeah.
Classic.
Yep. It's one of those songs that I think people don't know that he wrote it. Everyone knows the song, and I don't, you know, it's like, I don't think
Why do you think that?
What?
Why do you think that song became so famous? Why do you think that song became, like, his hit?
Maybe Frank Sinatra. I don't know. Like yeah, you know, there's, like, these people who, like, some of these famous singers who are singers outside of musical theater would pick up some of these songs. Kind of like how, like, a lot of people for the longest time didn't know that Not While I'm Around was from Sweeney Todd, because, like, Barbara Streisand sang it very famously on, like, an album, and she would, like, do it when she would go do live shows. And so people knew this song, and no one knows the context, and the context changes the song a lot. But if you've just heard, like, covers of Not While I'm Around, it's like, oh, what a lovely, beautiful.
Do you want to know what I just thought of when you said that?
What?
I completely mistitled the song in my Instagram post. I called it Nothing's Gonna Harm You, but it's called Not While I'm Around. But I called it Nothing's Gonna Harm You.
I think people would.
I know, but that sucks. Why did I do that?
You blew it.
You're not going to air this episode, are you?
I don't think that's as bad as me thinking that Sending the Clowns is from Pacific Overture.
But you didn't post about it on Instagram. You know why? It's because that song has been in my head since I was a little kid, and it starts with Nothing's Gonna Harm You.
Yeah.
And that's why, okay? Like, get off my back.
I can't believe I invited you on this show and you don't know shit.
Honestly, I'm a little surprised. You're like, what if you just did it to, like, totally trick me and troll me?
Yeah, I was like, we're going to talk about Stephen Sondheim, and then I just asked you a bunch of questions about musicals that you're like, is that a Sondheim musical? And I'm like, yeah, you've never heard Tricking the Ponies? You've never heard?
I mean, no, I've heard of Tricking the Ponies. I love that show.
It's my favorite. We did it in college, and I played.
Oh yeah, I did a black box production of Tricking. Yeah, who did you play?
I was Mitchell.
Oh god,
the pony wrangler.
I actually played the pony, weirdly enough.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool.
Tricking the ponies. Trixie the pony.
Trixie the pony and tricking the ponies.
Yeah, that's right.
Great. Awesome. This.
Great.
We know a lot. This was really, really great talking with you. I read your post and I was like, okay, cool. I'll talk to Emily because I like talking to you and that's a good excuse to talk to you. And because you're one of my friends that's on Broadway right now. So,
that's really nice. I feel also the fact that you want that, like, specifically about Sondheim and how much we're all thinking about him and thinking about his influence on us, that you wanted to talk to me about it makes me feel really honored.
Yeah. Well, I think you're great. And I think that, and I knew you would kill it and you did. Do you want to, like, is there a place people can follow you or like something that you want to plug?
Maybe I should plug my, ooh, is it gross to plug my album? Yes.
I was going to say, we talked about you being a songwriter. You should plug your album.
Should I?
Yeah, you should.
Okay, I just say it right now?
Yeah, you can say it right now.
Okay. So I have an album of original music and it is on Spotify and Apple Music. So both Austin and I can listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Little Longings.
It's fantastic.
It's by me, Emily Walton. Thanks, Austin.
It's great.
Thanks.
Emily Walton, Little Longings.
Yeah.
And do you want people following you on social media or no?
Yeah, you know what? You can follow me on Instagram. It's Lady Emily Walton, at Lady Emily Walton.
Because you're a lady.
I'm a lady and my name is Emily Walton. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So follow me.
All right. Well, have fun at the thing you're going to. And
I will.
You know?
I will. I got to take a shower. I haven't showered today. I have to go do that.
Go do that. Okay.
I'm really happy that we did this. It's also just nice to talk to you.
Yeah, it's nice chatting with you as well. So,
okay, we'll keep in touch.
I hope you're still doing the show in, like, I might be going out there in like April. And so I hope that you're still doing it. Yeah.
If it's open, I'll be there. So just hope that it's still open. Keep me posted. Let me know. Let me know if you're ever in town.
Will do.
And I can't wait to hear the episode.
Yeah. It should be up later this week. So
cool.
All right.
Kay. Okay. I'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Okay, that's it. Again, you can follow Emily at Lady Emily Walton on Instagram, you know. Go follow her there. You can, if you're in New York, go see her and Come From Away. You should go do that. Listen to her album on Apple Music or Spotify, Little Longings by Emily Walton. And I also think, God, go through that list, write them down, and listen to those songs that we talked about on the show. I believe you will like every single one of them. At the beginning of the show, I started the show off with an excerpt from the song Sunday, from Sunday in the Park. Emily and I talked about in the episode. And we also talked about in the episode, and I talked about this in the intro, about how when I was 12 years old, I went and saw the revival of Into the Woods on Broadway, didn't really get it. Then I got it later on in life, and we talked about, you know, the song No One Is Alone and what a gorgeous moment that is. I want to leave you with this moment, and I want to set it up again. I know I talked about this in the episode, but I want to just go into a little bit more depth on where this falls in the show. So if you haven't ever seen Into the Woods, first of all, you should go see it. There's a great movie that Disney did a few years back with Meryl Streep and Emily Blunt and some really solid performances. It's not as good as the stage version. It's just not. And I know I'm sounding like a snobby purist, but that's just the reality. Like, the show is built to be seen live. It's built for a two-act structure. It has a very particular act break that is very important for your experience of the story. So the way this goes down is you're following all of these grim fairy tales, Jack and the Beanstalk, Cinderella, Little Red Riding Hood, one about a baker and his wife that I don't know if I ever actually heard this one before, but it's like a baker and his wife who want a kid. But there's all these grim fairy tales that you're following along with, and they all end at the end of the first act. That's, you know, it's happily ever after, the way that you know them, the way that you've heard them a million times growing up. And so you're thinking at intermission, okay, so there's a whole other act to the show. What are we doing? And you come back, and almost instantaneously, the narrator of the show picks us up and lets us know that some time has passed. Everyone's gotten what they wanted. Jack was able to kill the giant, and he was able to get the giant's treasure. Jack and his mom are now really wealthy, and they're doing they seemingly have everything that they wanted to have. The baker and his wife wanted a kid. They've got the kid. Cinderella wanted to marry this prince. She's married to the prince. It happened. She got her dude. You know, everyone's gotten the things that they wanted to get. The problem is, what happens now? And they're all feeling a little underwhelmed or unfulfilled with the things that they thought they wanted. The baker and his wife are a little stressed out about parenthood and not sure that they're actually up to the task, as I think a lot of parents can relate to. You're so excited about the idea of having a kid, and now the kid is here. What now? What do we – it's not fixing the problems that were in our relationship. They had this kind of feeling like they're not connecting the way that they should romantically. They thought maybe a kid would help it. It's not helping it. They're still feeling this longing for something else. Cinderella, same deal. She always thought if she could get away from her stepmother and her stepsisters and get into this palace, that would fix everything. Here she is. She's with this guy, this prince, who he doesn't know what to do. The prince doesn't know what to do. He thought if he could get this princess, that would be his calling, that he would fulfill his kind of his calling as a Prince Charming. And they're here, they're married, and they're both like, oh, I guess I thought they were all sort of in love with this idea, this fairy tale idea of what it would look like to be married. And now they have to deal with the reality. And at the moment that this song occurs in the show, So Jack and his mom, they killed this giant, they got the giant's treasure. The giant's wife comes down looking for revenge. Like, you don't think about that when you hear that story that, hey, there's fallout. You don't just get to kill this guy and walk away scot-free. His wife comes down and she's like, hey, I want to talk to the guy who killed my husband. And so there's this whole scuttlebutt where the baker has been separated from his wife. They kind of separate from each other, and he doesn't know if he can take care of the baby all on his own. So he gives the baby to Cinderella. He bumps into Cinderella, who has left her husband. She's out in the woods because she doesn't know if she wants to be married to her husband anymore. He bumps into Cinderella. He says, here, take my baby. I don't know if I can be a father. I don't know if this is for me. He gives her the baby. Jack's mother has just been killed by this steward of the king who was afraid. His mom was kind of talking shit to the giant's wife. She's sort of calling out the giant's wife, and this guy was afraid that she was going to invoke the wrath of the giant's wife, and he kills her. He hits her on top of the head with this scepter and kills her. So Jack's mom is dead, and we find at this moment in the show, the baker is in a tree with Jack, who is resolved to kill this giant and then kill the guy that killed his mom. And the baker's trying to convince him, hey, that's not the way we should do this. You can't just kill this guy. And the kid's like, why not? He killed my mom. And the kid's looking to the baker for answers. And at the same time, somewhere else in the woods, Cinderella has this baby that this guy just handed her. This baker just handed her a baby and said, hey, here, you take care of my kid. And she's run into Little Red, who is also on her own path of being lost. And they're all dealing with the fact that, like, this giant's coming. So they've all got their own path of being lost and unfulfilled. And also there's this massive event coming toward them that they're all going to have to deal with. And in this moment, you know, Cinderella and the baker are sort of being looked at as parent figures by these kids who are desperate for answers, who are lost, who are saying, help me out. And they're looking back at the kids going, dude, I got my own problems. I am also dealing with being lost. And the best that they can offer to these kids is the simple notion that no one is alone. That if you feel lost, if you feel confused, if you feel like you don't know what to do, it might be a small consolation, but if it's the best I can offer you is this idea that you are not alone in doing this, in facing these trials. It's just such a singular example of why people in musical theater carry this man in such high regard, because of these moments where you think, I didn't think it was possible to pull such simple, true, honest depth out of a show about grim fairy tales. So here it is. It's one of my favorite songs of all time. It always makes me cry. I hope with that context, you can sort of feel it in that new way if you weren't already aware of that context, and enjoy this song. That's the show. Thank you so much for being here. Thanks to Chris Bjorn, who mixes and masters this show at Marmalade Music. We love him. Again, go check out Emily's album, Little Longings. You can check out my music, austin-archer.com, on my website, or by searching Austin Archer on Spotify or Apple Music, austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. I'm on Cameo now. You can get a Cameo from me if you want to get a Cameo for the holidays. If you want to order something for a family member, you can get a Cameo. That's like linked in my bio on most of my social medias. Okay, there's my plugs. Please do enjoy No One Is Alone by Stephen Sondheim from his musical Into the Woods.
Mother cannot guide you. Now you're on your own. Only me beside you. Still, you're not alone. No one is alone. Truly, no one is alone. Sometimes people leave you halfway through the wood. Others may deceive you. Isn't here now.
Wrong things, right things.
Who knows what she'd say?
Who can say what's true?
Nothing's quite so clear now.
Do things, fight things.
Feel you've lost your way.
You decide, but
you are not alone. Believe me, no one is alone.
No one is alone. Believe me.
Truly, you move just a finger. Lightest word, something's bound to linger. Be heard.
No one acts alone. Careful, no one is alone.
People make mistakes.
Fathers,
mothers,
people make mistakes. Holding to
honor their mistakes.
Fight for their mistakes.
Everybody makes
one another's terrible mistakes.
Witches can be right. Giants can be good. You decide what's right. You decide what's good.
Just remember.
Someone is on your side.
Our side.
Our side. Someone else is not. While we're seeing our side, maybe we forgot.
They are not alone. No one is alone.
Hard to see the light now.
Just don't let it go.
Things will come out right now.
We can make it so.
Someone is on your side.